Good morning. This is hour number two, Focus 580, our morning program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. Back in January of 2002, President George Bush signed the No Child Left Behind Act. Supporters of this legislation said that it would make schools more accountable. They also said that they thought that it would close some of the performance gap between white students and minority students. Now, on the other hand, there were critics who said that there was a problem with this act because it relied too much on standardized testing to measure student performance. And, of course, over time, also, there has been some criticism of the act from people who said it was never fully funded. In this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about No Child Left Behind and also about the issues of school accountability and performance. And our guest for the program is Lizanne DeStefano. She is Executive Associate Dean for Research and Administration in the College of Education. She's also Director of the Bureau of Educational Research and is Professor of Educational Psychology at the U of I. And we're pleased she could be here and spend a little time with us talking about the subject. Questions from people who are listening, of course, are welcome. As always, the only thing that we ask is that people just try to be brief so we can keep moving along, get in as many people as possible. But questions from listeners are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So whichever of those works best for you, you can give us a call, and we'd be very happy to have questions. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
I thought that even though there's a fair amount of discussion of No Child Left Behind, and periodically it's mentioned in the news, and we see stories and hear stories about how educators are trying to deal with this and how they react to it, I'm not sure how well people understand what No Child Left Behind is or even what it was intended to do. So just to start out, I think it'd be a good idea just to talk very basically about this legislation. Mm-hmm. What exactly was the idea, is the idea, behind No Child Left Behind?
Mm-hmm. Well, the roots of No Child Left Behind really began in a educational summit that was convened by George W. Bush, at that time the governor of Texas, which included other governors, at which Bush proposed some challenges to the educational system and talked about some things that governors could do based on the educational reform that he had led in the state of Texas. So we first saw inklings of this back in 1989. In 2001, 3 days after his inauguration, President Bush announced the framework for No Child Left Behind. And as you said, a year later, it was actually signed into law. No Child Left Behind is actually a reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is a federal law that has been in place since the 60s and talked about the federal role in education. The reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, the latest reauthorization of the ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, greatly expanded that federal role in ways that we've never seen before. Many people associate No Child Left Behind with the Bush administration, and there's a lot of talk now in Bush's last term of will we see big changes in No Child Left Behind when President Bush leaves office. I think it's important to understand that there was very strong bipartisan support for No Child Left Behind in its last reauthorization. Among the candidates today, Hillary Clinton and John McCain were both voted in favor of the reauthorization and were supportive. Obama was not a senator, not in Congress at that time, but has said that he is supportive of certain aspects of the law. And Edward Kennedy was one of the co-sponsors of the law. So even though it's generally associated with the Bush administration, there's actually a fair amount of support on both parties in terms of the law. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that what this aims at is what is now the big buzzword, I think probably has been a buzzword for a long time and for a while now in public education, and that is accountability. Mm-hmm. That is that people are saying – we want to see some concrete sort of demonstration that students are learning and that they're performing well. And that the way that, that we end up measuring that is by testing and reporting how the students are doing. And I think what the intent of the legislation was to say, because the on the federal level, I think there's still this strong commitment to the idea of local control. Mm-hmm. So the federal government says to essentially to the states, and maybe this even goes down to the local school districts, they'll say, well, we're not going to set federal standards. This is up to you to set the standards, but we're expecting you to meet the standards that you set. Mm-hmm. And then there are, I guess, perhaps some combination of carrots and sticks that go into trying to encourage the schools to meet those standards. Mm-hmm. So is that a reasonable way of talking about what really is going on here?
Yeah, and I think that's a great place to start. I think when you look at the intent or the premises of No Child Left Behind, most people would really not argue with those premises or that intent. It focuses attention on improved learning for all students, particularly those who have been underserved in the past, so low-performing students. There's an emphasis on closing the achievement gap between certain groups of students. They encourage states to adopt ambitious subject matter standards. They have a criterion of a qualified teacher in every classroom. They have an intent of increased flexibility in terms of how states and local education agencies use federal dollars. And they also talk about family choice about where they send their child to school. So when you read the intent of the law, you'd find very little disagreement on those premises, no matter who you talk to, teachers, principals, families, legislators, and so on. I think where the controversy around No Child Left Behind arises is on how that law has been enacted. And inevitably, when No Child Left Behind comes up, testing is the first thing that pops into people's minds. There's a perception, and in fact, we have some evidence that shows that the amount of time spent testing children, actual direct assessment, and the amount of time preparing children for tests has increased under No Child Left Behind and increased differentially among the lowest performing schools. So there is a tremendous pressure on all schools, but particularly those who tend to be low performing, for students to do well on the test. And one way that schools react to that is to spend time in test preparation. Now, the idea behind standards-based reform and accountability-based reform is not to focus on the testing, but to focus on presenting kids with engaging curriculum and high-quality instruction that will result in them doing better on the test. But the way that it's played out in many schools is the actual test itself is what's driving the curriculum. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that seems to be that is a concern of a lot of people, particularly a lot of educators. That is, what is the goal? What are we spending time in the classroom doing? What may we not be doing because we're so concerned about test preparation? And then also, I think there may be some concern among parents and teachers about the kind of pressure that that puts on the kids when it comes time to take the tests. Mm-hmm. Maybe the question is, why did that happen? Why has it gone that way? And would there be a different way to do it where you could meet the goal and have the students perform well on the test, mm-hmm. and yet at the same time do in your classroom instruction, do something that's broader and more well-rounded, and you would hope that would be directed at getting, you know, it's teaching students how to learn, mm-hmm. and not just teaching them how to pass the test.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that how it came to be that way is part in how the law was operationalized and implemented, in that so much rests upon a single test score, and that is the score on the state test. And that is combined with the fact that criteria and the amount of improvement that was expected of schools was set at such a very high level that there was a tremendous need to increase students' test scores within a very short period of time. So the language around No Child Left Behind is all students meeting or exceeding standards by 2013. So within a 10-year period of time, schools were faced with the challenge of bringing every child in their school up to a certain level of proficiency, and that proficiency was defined by an absolute score on an assessment. So from the very beginning, people understood in schools that that test score had a huge amount of importance, that there was a lot of ground to cover in a short amount of time, and so it took on a much larger role in implementation than probably was intended. You're right. An emphasis on curricular improvement, increasing educational opportunities, and all sorts of things are key to improving student performance. But somehow, the test became the real focus of the initiative. Mm-hmm.
And then you have to ask the question, as far as the schools were concerned, what was at stake if the students didn't meet the standards?
In Illinois, we've always had somewhat of a soft accountability system in that about the worst thing that happened to you in Illinois, if your school scored poorly on a state assessment, is you might get published in the newspaper in some kind of rank order where your school relative to other schools didn't do very well. And if your school failed repeatedly, some extra resources were brought to the school to try to improve student performance. So we've had an accountability system, but the sanctions were not particularly harsh, and there were kind of wide windows that schools had. No Child Left Behind narrows those windows. You've got to change very, very quickly, and the sanctions are potential dismantling of school, closing of a school and sending kids from that school to neighboring schools who are doing better. Or for a state, potential loss of federal funds. So the stakes are much higher both at the school level and at the state level for kids' failure to perform.
Yeah, so obviously that would explain why officials, state education officials, and teachers and school principals, why everybody would feel so much pressure to have the students meet the standards, because obviously you don't want to see those other things happen.
You don't want to see those other things happen. That's correct.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Okay. Let me again introduce our guest, Liz Ann DeStefano. She's a professor of educational psychology here at University of Illinois. We're talking some about the issue of No Child Left Behind, about student assessment and performance. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Tuscola to talk with on our line one. Hello.
Hello, Dr. DeStefano.
Hello.
Hi. I've been following several of the local school districts, mainly from Homer over to Monticello for about the last 3 years.
Okay.
For a news source. And the reason I have two issues I'd like you to touch on, if you could.
Sure.
First, several of these school districts right after No Child Left Behind saw a rapid rise in the number of students who got placed in the special education programs because those students were exempt from No Child Left Behind. And also, one particular school district has a large volume of non-native English speakers. And that school district is suffering from low achievement scores and is potentially facing not meeting goals year after year because of a lack of funding for getting those kids prepared to learn in an English-speaking classroom. And I know that the federal government says a lot of lip service. Do you see any movement happening in that? And I'm going to get off the phone and just listen on the radio.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, you touched on a lot of interesting issues in that question. First, with respect to kids with disabilities, the special education population, it was true that for many years, if a child was in special education, they could be exempt from taking the state exam and exempt from being counted in the school's accountability metric. Actually, under No Child Left Behind, that's no longer true. All students in a school have to participate in the in the state assessment, there is an option to have an alternate assessment, not the regular state test, but a different test for a very small number of those kids with the most significant disabilities. But kids with disabilities are required to participate in the state assessment in most cases. They can receive accommodations to do so. They can have extra time or be tested in a different setting or something like that. So actually, and special education students are one of the subgroups that a school must report on their performance separately. So they have an overall school total on the number and the percentage of kids who meet or exceed, and they now have to also talk about how many kids in special education meet or exceed. And they have to make adequate yearly progress. They have to hit a particular goal for everybody in the school. So if one subgroup, like students with disabilities, fail to meet or exceed, that can count against that school for in terms of meeting AYP. So it is a particular challenge for those schools who have a significant number of students with disabilities to be able to provide them with enough services to raise their achievement to meets and exceeds state standards. And so you've hit on an area that a lot of districts are challenged by, is how do we bring this particular group of students up to a state standard in the time frame that we need to do. On the positive side, it is resulting in more challenging curriculum and more effort being placed at kids who are at the lowest performance level. On the downside, schools feel very, very pressured to do that. With regard to English language learners, it's the same sort of situation. English language learners are required to take the test, and their performance is reported separately. So you're correct. If a school has a large number of English language learners, they are held accountable for that metric. And some schools feel that there needs to be more of a safe harbor or more of an accommodation, that when you're teaching a very diverse population, that you either have more time to bring them up to standards, or that you have some alternative standards that measures the more gradual progress of certain subgroups.
All right. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess this causes me to think about the fact that from time to time we have heard stories about school districts where they seem to have done some snarky things with how they classified students, and that they had ways to take students that were having real difficulties, that they were not able to meet the standards, and finding ways essentially not to count them. Does that kind of thing happen?
Yes, there's certainly evidence that that has happened in the past, and I think it's getting more and more difficult for schools to do that because the reporting requirements, the federal reporting requirements, and the state reporting requirements are asking schools to account for virtually every child in that school. And there's very narrow margins of error. Everyone is allowed for a certain number of kids who might be absent on the day of testing. Mm-hmm. But literally, schools are required to account for every child, and kids who don't participate are generally given a failing score. So they would actually count against the school. And so as a result, we see higher and higher and higher levels of participation in state assessment.
Okay. Another caller here, this one in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Just wondering, the tests are given in third, fifth, eighth grade in elementary school?
Actually, under No Child Left Behind, there's a requirement for annual testing from third through eighth grade. So they're tested every year.
And the ones, the scores that are sent to the state are those scores?
A single test, state-administered test once a year.
Can you speak to the issue in one sense that every year a third grade, I think this is correct, has to make a better progress than the previous third grade? Is that right? And every fourth grade? I mean, each year the expectations are a little higher?
Right. That's the type of accountability system that is under the current authorization of No Child Left Behind. There's an absolute criterion at each grade level, which is the percentage of kids who meet the standard at that grade level. And so third grade from this year is compared to third grade from last year to talk about the percentage of kids that meet that grade level. So you're right. Different cohorts of kids are being compared to each other. And this is viewed as a weakness of the current authorization of No Child Left Behind. Critics say it would be a much better approach to follow individual children and to see how much gain they make from year to year, more of a growth model, than to have this absolute criterion where you're comparing different groups of kids to assess growth.
Right, because the logic is really pretty ridiculous given how class composition or mobility or moving into a district of children from, you know, just say another part of the state. But so what is the hope that the comparison, you're actually comparing the third grade to last year's second grade performance, mm-hmm. I could say. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. great is the possibility that they're going to be able to change this model, because the other one is totally illogical?
Well, you know, this is a great moment in time because No Child Left Behind is actually up for reauthorization right now. So, and one of the biggest areas that is being considered under reauthorization is the problem of the state test as the single metric and this absolute criterion of meeting or exceeding standards. Five states have been allowed to do a pilot where they're looking at that kind of tracking individual kids and looking at growth. And there's a lot of advocacy, both from experts and from the general public, to look at growth models under the new reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. So I think that that is definitely on the table, and it's one of the areas that I think there's the most recognition that the law could be improved with this kind of a change.
Okay, and then one more question, and I'll leave. The issue of mobility, how is that handled? Because mm-hmm. some districts have as much as a third of children that are in and out. So you're getting children from other districts mm-hmm. that may have had better access to education mm-hmm. or less good access to education, and yet those children you are testing in the spring, and you mm-hmm. haven't really been their teacher, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm. This is an issue that was not really addressed in the last iteration of No Child Left Behind and was addressed a little bit in some of the regulations that followed, in that they set a date in the fall by which the children had to be enrolled for their test scores to count in the spring. And I think that it roughly translates to having been in that school district about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And so they have put something in the regulations that says that in order to count for that particular school, the child has to spend X amount of time in that school, which has given schools a little bit of relief. But it doesn't count for kids who are changing schools every year, you know, so they count for that school in the year that they're in there, but the next year they count in the next school, and it's not looking at the cumulative effect of a school on that particular child. Some of the growth models that are being proposed would account for that, because they track the progress of kids who had been in a school for a certain number of years, and that would give us a better idea of the value of that particular school, the impact of that school on a child's education.
Exactly. Thanks very much.
All sure. Right, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Muhammad, line two. Hello.
Yes. excuse me. I would like to say that I went to school a long time ago, and I went to a very poor school, and I had parents that cared about my schooling, not at all. And yet, all of the children in my school were required to do the basic things, reading, writing, arithmetic, all the rest. And teachers had other smart students help the ones who were having trouble. And it worked just fine. And we didn't have any of these tests. We didn't have all these counselors. We didn't have all this rhetoric about it. We didn't have these scores every year. And yet everyone moved ahead just fine. I taught at college myself recently, and these kids cannot spell, They cannot write a declarative sentence. They don't know any geography. They don't have any vocabulary. I mean, it is just unbelievable. So as far as I'm concerned, our teaching systems and our schools have just failed miserably, and I don't think we need all these this discussion and excuses about why children are not doing well. You know, the teachers are not teaching well or making the effort. I just don't believe all this other stuff. Please respond.
Well, I think that, you know, your comment reflects a lot of comments that we hear. I work in a college of education, and so people come up and talk to me about the state of our schools all the time. And I think there is a general public feeling among a large segment of our population that schools aren't working anymore, that they used to work. The schools that they remember were effective, and the schools of today are not. So one of the challenges that I think we face in a university and a college of education and as a society is what can we do to help our schools be effective again? We know society's changing, demographics are changing, educational opportunities are changing. Maybe the schools of today have to look very different than the schools of 10, 20, or 30 years ago. And so one of the things that we try to study and try to understand better is how do schools need to change to better serve the population of kids that attend them today?
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I hope the caller will forgive me because I have a couple of other people who are on hold, and I want to bring them into the conversation also to, again, introduce our guest, Lizanne DeStefano. She's professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois. She is also executive associate dean for research and administration in the College of Education and director of the Bureau of Educational Research. And we're talking about assessment performance and particularly talking about No Child Left Behind, what that was intended to do, perhaps what it has done, and questions are certainly welcome. The next caller is on a cell phone near Indianapolis, I guess. Line number three. Hello.
Okay. Good morning, Doctor.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I'm a former superintendent, and I'm probably one of the few, and maybe, again, I maybe I've been correct on this, but I laud the accountability. Maybe at times we need to have our feet held to the fire. I see some of the shortcomings of the Act, No Child Left Behind. The only disappointment that I feel, and I know there's any time we talk about accountability and assessment, is that in my study of various test scores in New York State and also in Illinois and a few other states, was that many times through the best intentions of state testing, I have found that the curriculum, the curricula of the school, was not aligned correctly to state standards. So there's a lot of a point along the way that the federal government could have helped mitigate some of these the problems that we're experiencing now. Maybe the act is the cart before the horse. In other words, to put resources behind best practices, effectiveness, alignment of state standards, curriculum. And I'm not saying that we should have a national curriculum, but a lot of the minutiae that goes on in the classroom and just being able to identify effectiveness is something that, you know, we could be tackling this problem of the accountability issue with the national mandates for testing, but at the same time we're not addressing the other issues. And I'll just take my call off the line.
All right, thank you.
Well, you raise an interesting issue about alignment, and certainly, if the goal is to have your students do well on the state assessment, then obviously there's pressure to align what is taught in the classroom with what kids are expected to know and do on the state assessment. And again, it's sort of a half full, half empty kind of a situation in that some people who feel that schools who have gone a great distance in aligning the classroom instruction with the test have actually ended up narrowing the curriculum in ways that limit educational opportunities for children. So No Child Left Behind mandates testing in reading, math, and science in the elementary grades. And so we have seen a great focus in schools, and particularly low-performing schools, on reading, math, and science, and a lot of resources and effort being placed with kids who tend not to do well in those subject areas. And for many people, they say that's a great thing. That's where the resources should be going. That's what we should be focusing on. Other people focus in on the fact that this may narrow the curriculum and opportunities for art or social studies or other aspects of the curriculum are actually diminishing for students. And part of the work that I do is I go into schools. I like to look at local implementation of federal mandates. So we have No Child Left Behind, and I like to go into classrooms and schools and find out, well, how's it working here? And one of the things that I hear most frequently is that they have actually reduced time and resources for some of the extracurriculars to focus more attention on the fundamentals and on particularly on low-performing kids. So this is a very common criticism of the Act, but it's also some people feel that in a time of limited resources, that was is an appropriate decision to make. But we do definitely see curricular shifts as a result of what's being tested.
And do you think that that's something that's likely to change, or are we going to be talking about the same problem a year from now and 2 years from now and I don't know how many years from now?
Well, you know, the idea of the school day, the school year, timing around schooling may be the thing that needs to change in our society now. The 9-month school year, the 8:15 to 3 school day may really not provide enough time for the types of educational outcomes and the types of gains that we want to see. So it may be, you know, if you're holding resources constant and you're holding time constant and you're being asked to show greater outcomes in certain areas, then it's only logical to take the time and the resources that you have and focus on those areas. One thing we need to think about in education is how do we use time more effectively? How do we create more time for learning during the academic year, during the calendar year, and during the school day? I think unless we create some other options in terms of times and resources, I think we are likely to see the same kind of narrowing continue. Yeah.
Next caller is in St. Louis, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask about any results might be coming from the fact that every year we see about 9% more children being schooled at home by their parents rather than in our school system, and if that's an issue that's been studied or not.
I think that homeschooling, the increased rates of homeschooling have certainly come under federal scrutiny and very recently. I just read some testimony the other day about how drastically homeschooling rates are increasing in some states in particular. In the information that I've read on it, it was not so much linked to No Child Left Behind or the requirements of No Child Left Behind, but some people's dissatisfaction with the climate of schools, some of the other requirements of schooling, maybe dissatisfaction with some of the curriculum or other expectations of schools. So I haven't seen that much of a link between increased rates of homeschooling and No Child Left Behind, but I know that there is concern about why so many families are opting not to utilize public schools.
Well, I know that a lot of the families that I know that homeschool are very against standardized testing,
mm-hmm.
and so that might be one of mm-hmm. the reasons, but they also have many other reasons
mm-hmm.
for homeschooling.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard as much talk about the standardized testing, although that may certainly be the case.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And again, we go to another caller, and this is someone in Elburn, line four. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I tell you, in my book, that No Child Left Behind law is basically defunct. My kids are all grown up and out of college, but we had a problem with my son, had a hard time with math. And it wasn't any kind of special deal except the day after, and the teacher helped him on how to do his math properly. He turned out fine. He's a business agent, downtown Chicago. He's doing great. His math is better than ever. And, you know, and it's not just that. I've heard other people in the same boat. Now, I'm 51. Okay. Back in my day, I had problems with math. I got help. And it wasn't anything special except for the teacher that it was the regular math teacher. Now, I see and I've heard examples of opposite of what you're talking about. And I firmly believe it's a regional thing. That you spend all this money with these school districts and you go absolutely nowhere. You're spinning your tires and the public school system, as far as I'm concerned, is debunked. And I think, quite frankly, that's why you're seeing a lot of people homeschooling, a lot of people going to private schools. There is no accountability for a failure. And every time they come up with a new idea, it might be good for some, but it's not good for the whole in general. You know, you're basically right now taking a minority amount of people who don't deserve this. These people are special ed kids. You know, the teachers that are teaching the class ought to have the time to help these students out. And going to another student, going to a psychologist major, you know, trying to do something the opposite than what really should be, and you know, is wrong. And I don't know, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I've always seemed to think that everybody I know that's doing fine without that No Child Left Behind law, I think there's more of them than the stories. And nobody tells those stories. Yeah. So, and that's just my 10 cents. I'll get off and listen.
Sure. And I guess I don't – you could take this in a number of directions. And you can respond any way you want. Obviously, the kind of criticisms that the caller makes of public schools are very common, and I'm sure that a lot of people would agree with him. And particularly when you think about the kind of burdens that are put on teachers, and you know, one would wonder if we could somehow manage to get more teachers, we could get the size of the classes smaller, so because you know that children will benefit by more one-on-one time with the teacher. I don't know. You can respond to that.
Yeah. Way. You know, I think that the schools that have really approached No Child Left Behind most constructively are those schools that, yes, they pay attention to the test scores, but really what they're trying to focus on is creating a set of instructional conditions that really enable teachers and kids to be successful. And one of the basic criticisms of No Child Left Behind is in some ways it's an unfunded mandate in that some of the things that are needed to reduce class size, to increase the numbers of highly qualified teachers within a school or within a classroom, to provide good instructional opportunities after school or during the full school year are not a part of the No Child Left Behind equation. The responsibility there is for states and localities to provide funding for that, and not at the federal level. So education is a very complex endeavor that involves teachers, students, community, family, and so really trying to say how can we put together a set of conditions within and outside the school that promote learning in that community is really the basic idea between educational reform today. And No Child Left Behind is trying to get at it through accountability and test scores, but really the issue is a much broader one than that.
Just for a minute to talk a little bit about standardized testing. I think that you know, some people would say, well, if what we really want to be able to do is to compare one student to another, one classroom to another, one school to another, we have to have the easiest, most straightforward way to do that is to have everybody take the same test, and then we'll have some numbers, and then we can really make some comparisons. But when you do that, obviously you got the kind of problems that you're talking about with teaching the test and mm-hmm. being overly consumed with test scores and so forth. I mean, is there a better way, I'm sure that there are better ways to measure student performance, but when you're talking about large schools and lots of kids, are there really other viable ways to do it other than standardized tests?
Mm-hmm. Standardized tests are attractive to many people because it does reduce a very complex issue down to a number. Mm-hmm. And numbers are easy to compare, and they're easy to add and subtract and do all kinds of things with. So they're very appealing, and particularly to lawmakers, there's a lot of investment in that kind of measurement and that kind of representation of learning among the legislature. And that's why testing is so popular in so many states and is a big part of No Child Left Behind. Is it possible to represent student performance differently? Absolutely. You can do multiple measures of student performance. Look at it in terms of evaluating student classroom work or student behavior in a classroom, in addition to on-demand kinds of performances like a standardized test. But all of those ways require much more time and much more expertise in terms of the people that are making the decisions. So the issues of teacher quality and instructional time are absolutely essential in thinking about how can we represent student performance differently.
Let's see. Maybe to just very quickly again introduce the guest, Lizanne DiStefano. She's professor of educational psychology here at University of Illinois. We're talking about student performance, the accountability issue in public schools, and particularly we've been talking about No Child Left Behind. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of the show. We'll talk next with a caller in Savoy, and this is line number two. Hello.
Obviously, something has gone wrong. Now, we got to the moon and back with a space program, and there were so many scientists involved. You had to different layers to build that up over the 10 or more years that they did. They couldn't have all gone through private primary and secondary schools. So many of them had to come to America's grade and high schools. And they were good enough, but you heard the woman call about how today's college students can't compose sentences, et cetera. Oh, do you have any idea what went wrong and what is being done in the education colleges to correct things?
Well, it's interesting that you mention the space race and Sputnik, because there's often parallels drawn between that era in American history and the current era. Because if you recall, at that point, there were the same kinds of concerns about America's ability to compete in the race for space. And
that was at the college and beyond level, though, not the grade school.
Well, actually, no, because one of the responses to Sputnik was effort to increase the number of highly qualified teachers. And many states, and actually even at the federal level, there were scholarship programs and incentive
what
programs.
What went wrong, and what are you doing now to make it better?
Well, let me finish my analogy there. There were many programs to encourage people to enter the field of teaching and to improve the conditions of teaching it for both salary and also working conditions. And I think we might be at another point where we need to rethink the profession of teaching, who's going into teaching, and why or why not is it attracting the right number and the right type of individual. We haven't seen similar scholarship programs, similar investment by state and local governments to support the profession of teaching. And so I think in critical shortage areas, and math and science is an area where we have a critical shortage of teachers, not only in Illinois, but nationwide, highly qualified students are opting to not enter the field of education because of working conditions, salary, and a perception that it isn't a very valued field today. So I think one of the things that we need to do is think about the role of education in our society today, how much we value teachers, how we recognize their professionalism and accomplishments, and see if we can't use that to really ensure that we'll have high-quality teachers in all of our classrooms working with our kids.
We're coming down here to just a couple of minutes left. We got a caller from somebody who asked their question off the air, and I don't know if there's something that you can talk about, mm-hmm. but it was interested in having you say something about how the United States is doing in terms of academic achievement as compared to other countries. Mm-hmm. It seems to be the thing that periodically we hear this mm-hmm. from time to time. And generally, it seems to be a story that says the U.S. students lag behind students in other country mm-hmm. in X thing. Mm-hmm. Could be math, could be science, could be, you know, whatever it mm-hmm. is. Is it really the case that the gap in performance between American students and, say, students in Japan or in Europe is all that big?
Mm-hmm. I think that for many years, these comparisons have been going on for decades. And for many years, we said, well, yes, there are these differences. In America, U.S. students do tend to perform lower than some other industrialized countries, certainly the Asian countries, but actually in recent years, lower than even many European countries. And a lot of times these differences were sort of rationalized away by saying, well, actually, different types of kids are being assessed in different countries. And in the United States, where there's free public education for everybody, we're getting a much broader range of society than in other countries that have a much more selective public education system. But actually, in more recent studies, there have been efforts to make sure that the populations were quite comparative. And there is pretty strong evidence to indicate that our kids do not perform as well as kids in many other countries, particularly in the areas of math and science. And I think partly that deals with how we integrate math and science into the curriculum. At what age do we do it, and what are our expectations at each grade level? And it's certainly one of the things that fuels this idea of dissatisfaction with public education and No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm.
We are very short on time. I have one more caller here. Okay. I do want to try to give them a chance in Crystal Lake on line number one. I have to ask you to be brief, though, but please go ahead.
Yeah, it seems to me that this accountability, which is not in private schools, but in public schools nowadays, it has meant that to enable additional privatization for religious schools and private schools. And I think that's been the object of this No Child Left Behind. I find that when I look at the curriculum in high schools and grade schools, it's really superior curriculum and really very standardized. I don't see, if you're not a minority language person, how the students can be so bad in English, as some callers say. There haven't been some of the so-called poorer area schools, not enough funding, and so therefore probably not enough funds because there's not enough books always, even in middle schools. And I think we don't have a real equal educational system, in that if we had an income tax funding for schools, it should be that all the schools would get equal proportion of the money, whereas when you rely on factories to produce the revenue for schools, you get poor areas don't get the income for the books and things. But I do think that the public schools are even better than when I went to school.
That's one vote of confidence mm-hmm. for the public
That's
schools.
Great.
What do you think about about private schools, and does No Child Left Behind, that doesn't, those standards don't apply to private schools, do they?
No, for the most part, they don't apply. They apply only to public schools, and only to public schools who receive federal funds. So certainly in some communities, they would say that there's an increase of private school options as a result of dissatisfaction with public schools. But one of the things that you also see is that in many communities, there aren't, and particularly those communities of low socioeconomic status. So the idea of privatization is occurring in certain areas and not, and that also kind of forces a difference between private education and public education access for kids across the state. I wanted to say just one more thing about earlier caller asked, so what are colleges of education doing? And one of the things that, many colleges are doing, and ours at University of Illinois is one of them, is really looking to not solve these problems alone, but to partner with local school districts, to partner with the community, to bring in lots of constituencies interested in public education to look at these complex issues and figure out how to move ahead in one small area and in one local community. And we've created something called the Center for Education in Small Urban Communities, which is a partnership to look at these issues of student achievement and performance and see how we can work together to improve schooling. Hmm.
Well, I think that we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm sure that we'll get back to some of these issues again. It's something that I'm sure we'll be talking about for a long time to come. With that, we want to say thanks to our guest, Lizanne DiStefano. She's professor of educational psychology at the U of I. She's also director of the Bureau of Educational Research and executive associate dean for research and administration in the College of Education. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David.
This program, excuse me, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. That's about it for us. Just a reminder that, of course, you can listen online. We're streaming our programming on WILL-AM, so you can listen through your computer. If you go to WILL.UIUC.edu, you can hear us, and that way also you can go to our web archives if you'd like to go back and listen to some past programs from Focus 580, Afternoon Magazine. All of the local production is there anytime that you're interested in listening, and it will tell you everything you need to know about doing that. So that's at will.uiuc.edu. And again, also a reminder that coming up next week on Monday, we'll be doing our regular monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies will be joining us, and if you're interested in calling in and talking about some problem that's come up around the house, something needs to be repaired, you're thinking about making some changes, he knows a lot about the single-family home and how it's all put together, and would be very happy to try and help you out if you'd like to call. So that's Monday. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope you will stay tuned, because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we are going to talk about Peter Mark Roget. Our guest will be journalist Joshua Kendall. He is the author of The Man Who Made Lists, Love, Death, Madness, and the Creation of Roget's Thesaurus. Kendall will join us at 106. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. In Kansas City, March wheat, $12.85, down 10. In Chicago, March wheat, $11.94, down 40. May, $11.76, down 68. July, $11.38, down 75.5. March corn, $5.44.5, down 15.25. May, $5.53, down 16.5. July, $5.65.75, down 15.75. December, $5.67.5, down 15.75. March beans, $13.40, down 47. Excuse me. May soybeans, $13.52.75, down 50. July, $13.70, down 48.75. November, $12.75, down 45.5. March meal, $3.37.50, down 15.50. March oil, $61.13, down 97. May oil, $60.56, down $2. At the Merck in Chicago, April live cattle, 90.20, up 65. June, 90.60, down 37.5. March feeder cattle, 99.20, down 25. April, 102.60, up 67.5. And April lean hogs, 55.05, down 2.15. Now to the outside markets. April crude, 110.16. It's in that neighborhood. It's hopping along here. Let's 110.20 down 13.